welcome back to episode 66 of Talking Marketing. I'm Chetna, your host, your producer, your guide through the minds of marketers actually doing the work. Let's get into today's guest. Most people in marketing collect titles, VP of this, CMO of that. My guest today has collected something rarer, a diagnosis. Neil Cohen has spent 40 years inside some of the biggest brands in the world, Hilton, Arby's, Sega, and alongside some of the scrappiest startups you have never heard of. Biotech, ag tech, vegan food, aerospace, over 120 companies across nearly every industry you can name. And somewhere along the way, he stopped calling himself a consultant. He calls himself a marketing therapist. Not because it sounds clever, but because it's actually what he does. He walks into the rooms where brands has lost the plot, finds the thing that nobody is saying out loud, and says it. Today, we are going to find out what the diagnosis usually is and what 40 years of watching companies get marketing wrong teaches you about getting it right. Welcome, Neil. Let's get into it. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. What an intro, Chetna. Thank you so much. Well, where do you want to start?
Interesting person and interesting bio goes hand in hand. So we'll get right to the point. You call yourself a marketing therapist. Most people hear that and smile. What's the real idea behind it? What's the diagnosis? What's actually wrong with the most companies think about marketing?
Right. Well, first, about the title itself, you know, I think that if you're going to talk to people about branding and storytelling, you have to eat your own donuts. And I was looking out in the landscape. It's like, what do you put in your LinkedIn and all that kind of stuff? And you know, honestly, consultants like me were kind of a dime a dozen. There's a billion of us out there. You see it on LinkedIn. Everybody's like, and they, you know, there's a lot of hyphens and adjectives. And, you know, like people have saved the world a couple of times over. And I just said, you know, it really, that's not what people are buying. What people are buying when they buy a consultant is a point of view. You don't buy process, everybody's got process, but you got a way of looking at the world. And the marketing therapist came from this idea that the best marketing comes from empathy with your customers, truly understanding them and understanding their pain. And to your point of asking, what's the problem that most, especially with young companies, but big companies have it too, is they don't touch base with their customers before they do their marketing. And they say, people all the time say like, oh, we talk to our customers all the time. And I just go like, so you asked them what features they liked and you asked them how they liked your company. And they go like, yeah. And they go, oh, that's like the worst thing to do. Okay. Because people want to please. They're a lot like the GPTs that are out there in AI right now. They want you to be happy. So they're going to say things like, oh, that's great. Oh, that's fine. You know, I like that. Or they're going to tell you what kind of feature or thing they like based on what they already know, not what can be made. So the biggest mistake, to your point, is diving in and understanding a customer's day, your ideal customer profile. What's their pain? What do they get measured on? How do they go about using their tools? Why do they do it that way? When do they decide that they're tired of the things that they're using to overcome inertia to get something new? What kind of rubric do they use to make those decisions? Why do those things matter and why are they important to them? And marketers don't do that anymore. And so marketing therapist comes from just that idea, which is you really have to dive in deep and understand people before you can really tell a good story.
That's an amazing insight that talking to people might sound actually the right path to a lot of people, because what are you building your product for? You talk to the people and then you see what's happening and then you produce the product and fix it if you need. But then also to remember that people are people pleaser. They will say and agree on every point that you say. So how will you get an accurate feedback on that? There's actually, if you go into the market and get a notepad writing down what's wrong, you will either get everything that's wrong or you will get the most perfect product. There's no in between. So that's actually a great insight.
Well, you know, there's always this mistake about, and people do this all the time. Like you hear about a friend's company or somebody says, I'm doing this or this. And they're like, oh, I got a tagline for you. Or I got it. Like, And the first place where everybody goes is typically where everybody goes. And if you look at any category, and so I'll, your gentle listeners out there, if you're in a category, go look at your top five, top 10 competitors, and look at how they talk about themselves. And they'll all use the same exact language, the same words, the same hyphenated adjectives. It's all what you call homogenous. And people always want to be different, but you can't be different if you're just getting in a room and brainstorming and saying, like, oh, you know, like we have to say this and we have to say that. That's not the way to do it. What I've learned over doing this for many, many years is that if you're truly empathetic with the customer and you ask open-ended questions and you don't lead the witness, that they will write your tagline for you. Literally write it for you, like almost verbatim. And I always say it's kind of like marketing jujitsu. You take your customer's language and you use it to get more customers. But people think that they're smarter than that, and they tend to like, let's get in a room, let's brainstorm, let's figure it out. We got our messaging done, and it's usually just mediocre at best.
You were a VP at Hilton, then Arby's, a turnaround, and then Sega. Three completely different brands, all in crisis or transition in some way. Looking back, were you already doing therapy back then, or was it just a name without it?
No, I was a career in transition. You know, I started in public relations at an agency. I was very fortunate to get in with some wonderful people and had a great mentor. And I got promoted fairly quickly and I became a partner at that agency, but then we sold it. I started another agency and Hilton was our customer. But when I was at that other agency, I got a little frustrated because I was in PR and I remember I felt like I was strong on strategy and conceptualizing, like problem solving, puzzle solving. And I was in a meeting with our ad firm that was our partner, and I came up with an idea for a strategy. And the person on the other side of the aisle from the ad agency looked at me and says, Neil, no, you don't understand. We're the ad agency, you're the PR firm, we do the strategy, and you just go out and PR it. And in my mind, my internal dialogue, it started with an F and ended with a U.
That's really.
But that was a seminal moment in my life. Like, that was such an important moment in my life because that's when I decided it's like I really need to go in a different direction with my career. So you asked me about these other things. So was I a therapist yet? No, but I had kind of thought, like, how do I get permission to be a strategist when right now people look at me in this bucket of a PR person? And so you had to be very kind of conscious about how you kind of manage the jobs that you want to go afterwards. When I started the second agency, we weren't a PR firm, we were a marketing communications firm. And the idea behind that at the time, which was a little forward thinking, was that we're going to attribute all of the things that we were doing in communications towards bottom line kind of stuff. Like, did we drive transactions? Did we drive signups? Like, we were going to be accountable for those kind of things with the programs we developed. That's when I got hired into Hilton. So I went from that firm and they gave me this job. I said, like, oh, this is interesting. I'm going to be an officer at a Fortune 500 company. And I was a fairly young at that age. I think I was 30 or something like that. But like, I'm going to be able to start morphing my career a little bit from marketing communications to a VP of marketing and communications. When I went to Arby's, I learned quite a bit from the people there and the rebrand there. But I participated in the rebranded Hilton, where that was a big deal because we were like, all of our customers were dying off. They were all in their 70s or older. So we had to push it down a little bit. So that was fun to participate in bringing in a new agency and developing that new campaign. When I got the job at Arby's, I had asked for a lot of things that weren't in my job description at Hilton. I had asked to be on the new products team. I'd helped to be on the executive committee of the company because I was going to be developing communication strategies. I had direct responsibility for the relaunch with the other team members and the brand. So it wasn't like, oh, Neil's on the team. It was like I had my review was based on some of these goals that I never had before. And then Sega was kind of like the complete transition where I went to strategy. But you were asking what were the challenges across them? And he's like, It's funny. Hilton was trying to find its way from its long-term customer because Hilton, they had to push down younger because brands like Starwood were pushing younger, like W Hotel and the Westin and all that kind of stuff. And like you it, and it was just a smart business decision, right? For Arby's, that was a brand that just had not had a lot of care for a while. There was dissent between the franchisees and the brand owners, like down to the menu board. I mean, little things like they called the roast beef sandwich the regular. Who calls your sandwich the regular? Like so little things like that, like just changing it to the classic, right? Makes a big difference. But it was even getting them to invest money in their stores where they're making, their stores are paid off and they're making money every year. But we were telling them, look, you can up your average store sales and pay for this back in a year and a half or 2 years. But if you own 10 stores, you don't want to take on that kind of debt. So really interesting kind of, challenges along the way to convince people that they had to uplift the brand. And it was actually the start of when other roasted meats came into Arby's where, now it's we got the meats. We weren't, we're back then it was we it's better out there, but we brought in turkey and chicken and other roasted things to give the menu more variety. At Sega, gosh, that was interesting. That's a case of hubris. Worked with a lot of smart people there, but they were number one when I went there, and they were a newcomer. Sony was coming out with the PlayStation, and we were going to have Sega Saturn. And we got our butts kicked. And that was a sense of the brand not listening to its customers and understanding its customers. And it lost its way. So they went from number one to not being number one anymore and getting out of the platform business altogether because they misfired with Saturn and then Dreamforce because they didn't listen to their customers. So it's a great education over that like 6 year span of going from those companies to see completely different problems of how the brands lost their way and how two of them kind of got their mojo back and one of them lost it completely.
Picking on that point where you said brands don't actually listen to people, don't you think it's still relevant today?
Well, people think that the company owns the brand, but the customer owns the brand. It's what they think of you, not what you think that they think of you.
That is true.
You guys aren't out in California, but there was a great coffee brand called Phil's, and I knew the founders and lovely people, and they sold to private equity. But it was this great brand where they used to personally make your cup of coffee and then say, like, taste it, do you like it? And you interacted with the barista in a way never before. And the operations people came in, and now you have to go to the register and order there and just pick up your cup of coffee, and it kind of lost its soul. And then they recently just told all 80 stores you can't have a gay flag in or an inclusion flag in the property. And there's this just, it was like the last straw, right? A week later, sorry, we made a mistake. But, that's just not understanding who you are. Like you're a Bay Area brand, born and bred. You pushed into Los Angeles, some other markets, but your base was about this difference, about this tolerance, about doing things a different way and being fresh and inclusive. And they stopped listening to their customers.
And they wonder what went wrong.
Yeah.
So.
They wonder what went wrong. Yeah, they went corporate. It's interesting. When I look back at Sega, and there was this crazy new thing at the time called the internet. And I used to go in then like these just chat rooms, and you guys would crack up if you see it was just literally Wild West people throwing things out there, saying whatever they wanted. And when I was at Sega, I was in charge of customer service, and I would hear the calls, and I would like we had somebody send back one of our platforms. It was this kludgy 32X platform, expletive deleted, like across the bot, they on their own dime, they put the platform in a box, shipped it back to us, UPS, telling us what they thought of us. And like this was going on. And then I'd be in the chat rooms and I'd be going, like, people are really upset about this interim platform. And like, I think it's bad news. And you guys want to put $8 million into this over Christmas, but nobody's liking it. And we're not going to be making any more games and for it. And I was basically told that if I brought it up again, I was persona non grata. which means I was already persona non grata at the time. And we had 400,000 of them in the barn that we had to sell, that the Japanese we were promised to sell, right? And we didn't sell any of them with $8 million worth of advertising before it. I mean, like barely, because the word was already out on the street in these internet chat rooms, but the leadership refused to listen to what was going on in the marketplace. And it was competing against the Saturn, which was the platform we wanted to get everybody on. So you can watch brands do these things in real time and go like, literally, I was doing like the scream, but it didn't matter.
It's crazy that brands still think that they own it and the public opinion does not matter because, they can push any product and people will just get on it and they'll just buy the product because, it's out there. But it does not work like that. You have to have that appeal to it. You have to listen to what your customers are saying. And no wonder they did not sell anything.
Well, no, the word was out. It was not something that you want to take home. But it was also back that when I learned about the power of the internet, and it wasn't even organized yet. I mean, it was like Netscape was just launching, where you had like these browser interfaces and all this kind of stuff. And it was crazy. It was a funny story. Like Sega, somebody had bought our URL, like Sega.com. It was the Southeast Gaming Association, and they just put pictures of deers like on the site, and they said like, well, we'll sell it to you for $50,000. And I said like, no, like we're not going to buy it from you. We already have an alternative right now. I think we had SegaGames.com or something like that, but eventually we got them down to a reasonable amount of money.
I've heard so many stories like this where people buy some URL and they later on sell it. There was this one, I think there is this country which uses the .ai, and now that AI has been, such a big proponent of our lives. They tried to buy that and the country refused. So now they have to come up with alternatives that where they can use the word AI, dot AI, and it's crazy. It's
That's pretty
actually
funny.
really crazy.
All the great initials that are out there, right? But back then, I mean, but people have made millions and millions of dollars on owning certain names. In this particular instance, we were able to get it back quick, but it's funny how that stuff works.
That
So.
is true. Arby's is the one I really want to dig in. We have talked about Sega, but with Arby's, you walked into a stagnant brand as a part of a turnaround team. What does it actually feel like to be in the room when the brand has already lost its plot and nobody will admit it?
Well, it's every crisis is an opportunity. And they had new owners that were willing to invest money into the brand to a certain extent. But the challenge there is that there was this huge dissent, as I had mentioned earlier, between the franchisees and the owners of the brand. And this had been going on for many, many years, that the owner of the brand was cited for securities fraud. And I think, if I do recall correctly, he was the only person by the Securities and Exchange Commission who's ever been banned from trading stocks ever again, like a lifetime ban. And now this company, Treyarch, Nelson Peltz and Peter May bought the brand, and they owned RC Cola, which was kind of like a tired cola brand. And eventually they pulled a few other things into it. But I think we just saw it all as a little bit obvious, because I had a lot of experience in fast food with McDonald's and Taco Bell. Some of the other people were at Taco Bell, and their brands, and that's how I knew them, because the Taco Bell people were my client for my marketing communications people. So it really was like, what do you have here? Like who, and went back to the customers. What are they coming for? And believe it or not, people really liked Arby's. They liked the taste, they liked the style, but there was a lot of things that weren't going right, like basics, like 6 out of 10 of the sandwiches being made that came out, right? And were being made correctly. That means 4 out of 10 customers were getting a crappy experience. The bun wasn't toasted properly. The meat, like, wasn't enough meat on the bun. It didn't look like the picture, whatever, all that kind of stuff. I mean, that's not a recipe for success, pun intended. The menu had gotten stagnant. Franchisees started bringing in their own items, right? Like, you know, like in different regions. So it wasn't consistent. You're walking to an Arby's and like that's what you like of what you like about chains, because it's like every now and then they have a special, but it was consistent. So it was really, you know, just like going back to basics. Like, what are we known for? Let's clean up the menu board. Let's not call our main sandwich the regular. And let's call it, you know, the classic. Let's bring in a couple of variations off of that. So we started bringing in some variety off of that sandwich. Then we started testing, because I was with the new products group, other roasted meats, things that, again, you have permission to do. Like, well, if you're selling roast beef, you can do roast chicken, you can do roast turkey, you can do roasted potatoes, you can do, right? You know, like you can start thinking about the th things that you can expand into. And really try to kind of up level the brand a little bit. And then the last part of it was like, how do you get the stores on board and have them invest in the stores and clean up the stores and get the operations going? And that was probably the hardest part of it, because you can do the menu board and you can clean that up and you got to sell it in. And that was hard work because of the animus that existed before, right? But now you got new people. Okay, we'll try to work with you. But getting them to invest and clean up the stores was hard. And getting them to put extra training into their crew was hard. But we did, before we even launched the national brand campaign, after we got the franchisees on board, changing the menu, getting some of these new products out there, we were still operationally out of sync. So we did a program, marketing did this. I led it with the operations team. It was called One Perfect Sandwich, Ops. OPS. And the goal was, can we get to 8 out of 10 before we launch the new campaign? So that was the benchmark. And so we started with 6 out of 10, and in 2 months we got it to 8 out of 10, and then we launched the advertising.
That's
Because,
amazing.
but well, so there's an adage that a lot of your listeners have probably heard before: nothing kills a bad product faster than good marketing.
Personally
Right?
experienced that.
Right. You don't want to bring all of these people into the stores with like new, exciting Arby's. It's like the same, pardon my French, shitty sandwich that I left before. Like, okay, I'll give them another chance, right? So it was a lot of fun, because it was, you couldn't do worse.
That is true. That is, and especially when you have like got into a room where people are actually making sure that the product stands out and everyone is ready to listen. That's the first step, I think, to make sure that the people around you are ready to listen to the ideas that you are saying. Because if there is no one to, act on it won't be floated. And to get 8 out of 10 is like from a 6 is like a huge improvement.
Well, and it's also how you talk about yourself. I remember our boilerplate, like, you know, everybody has the about us they put on a news release, and it said like Arby's is the 13th largest fast food franchise in the world. And I was like, I'm getting rid of that. Like, yeah, we're number 13. Yay. There's just different ways that you can position and talk about yourself that builds more confidence, because you can still be one of the world's leading or largest without saying you're number 13. You know, there were some brilliant people there. Terry Davenport was the CMO, a guy named John Vanderslice. So, you know, Terry went on to be CMO at Starbucks. John Vanderslice went on to be president of Hilton Hotels Luxury Brands. I learned a lot from those people. They really taught me the essence. My friend Mark Weiser, still close with him today, has his own marketing research firm out of Durham, North Carolina, who works with huge brands all the time. So some super sharp, smart people. And that's been probably where I've been luckiest, that I've worked with smart people. Even at Sega, where they had a lot of hubris, they were brilliant humans there. They just couldn't see the forest through the trees at the moment.
With your experience at Arby's, it's like birds of the same flock. So that's that.
Sure.
You have worked in around 120 companies. Is there still a brand that you want to look at and you want to work with?
Yeah. Well, you know, and you said 120. I think it's probably more like in the 300s, but like who knows? Is there a particular brand that I would want to work with? You know, I think the answer to the question is a little bit different. Like I look at every time that like I get into one of an engagement, It's a puzzle. Like everybody's got those personality tests that they do. There's a million of them out there. And every time I do one of them for the fun of it or in some exercise or some workshop, it always comes out the same. I'm like a puzzle solver. Like I like puzzles or problems. And I'm a teacher mentor. And it's like it never comes out different. And so it's kind of funny that I like that's where my career has ended up anyway. So nothing is boring to me. People go, oh my God, that's so boring. But if you dive into things and learn about things, you realize that some of the most boring things are the most important things. And not only are they important, but like they can be actually really interesting if you dive in and you learn about them. So for me, it's not so much like, oh, I'd love to work for that company. It's like, oh, that's a dicey problem. And that's how I tend to look at it. Like, that's a good one. Like, I want to, because you have no idea how it's going to work out. People like all the time they say to me, how do you know we're going to get the best story possible? And I go, like, I don't. But let's dive in and see what happens. You got to do the work, right?
After such a long experience, they just have to believe your word for it because you have seen it all and actually really seen it all. And when you say that you see companies as problems and where the issue is to fix them, you're actually nailing that therapist context in your tagline. You're actually working with the
Right.
therapist. It's not just a tag, it's what you actually do. It's what you breathe, what you live. So
Oh no, well, I was going to say when I decided to go out and do this, it's funny because there's a lot of things you can do as a consultant. And I tell people who go out in consulting all the time, don't be a generalist, pick a niche. And the pain that I found that most people have is that they're not very good at storytelling for all the reasons we talked about a little earlier. They brainstorm, everybody wants to do and oh, like what's the most important thing about you? No, there's three things, and people can't remember all that. So that's where I kind of said, like, here's where I'm going to focus on that area of pain, helping people find their North Star, but not just find the North Star, but how do you operationalize it? Because, again, it's about point of view. So empathy is my first point of view. And the other is that brands, no matter what they are an experience. It doesn't matter whether it's a service or a product that you hold in your hand or whatever it is, there's an experience around it. And everybody goes like, oh, that's not true. I used to do something in my class that I taught at SF State where I'd throw a paper clip up on a during in the presentation, I go, what is this? And a trick question. They go, it's a paper clip. I said, is a paper clip a brand experience? And everybody goes like, well, no, really, it's just a paper clip. I said, well, what if you do this? And I click the slide and you've seen like the paper clips that are multiple colors, right? Oh, how about if you do this? What if you make the paper clip in the shape of musical notes, right? Like, so I had all of these different types of paper clips. And then the last one I would say, like, would any of you use this paper clip on a formal report? And it was like a feather, like a pink feather with a little clip on the end. And everybody goes like, no. I said, well, what if you were the brand manager for Barbie?
it would work.
You have to think of everything, whether it's a paper clip or software as a service or a consumer packaged goods or a hotel room or an airline. Everything's an experience. And so that narrative, that North Star drives that. It determines what your brand expressions are from your logo to your tagline, what your colors you pick, what your sales team is, what your customer service is like, all of that, right? Your T's and C's. Like, we're a transparency company. Then how come your T's and C's are 20 pages long? Right. All right. But that's a thing, right? And that's all part of thinking through how do you deliver that service or product consistently across all touch points.
That makes sense. That makes sense.
But what you're asking right now is, okay, so here's the key about trying to find that narrative. There's a couple of things that you want to look at. I always say there's this kind of Venn diagram of internal truths and internal beliefs. Everybody thinks a company does all these great things, and people think this is why our customer buys us. Some of them might be true. Most of them are usually not. You're usually missing some nuance or something along that because you have confirmational bias in creating the products and all of those kind of things and selling them. But there's some inherent truth internally. Then there's what your customer thinks. that you are and why they buy you. Like they truly, well, I buy them because they solve this problem for me and this pain, and that's why I love them. And so you're looking for that overlap. The Venn diagram is what's true internally at the company and what the customer is thinking of true. That becomes your core pillar. And the other part of that Venn diagram, okay, is another circle that doesn't overlap either one. And it's what are your competitors saying? Because we got back to earlier where there's homogeneity among your competitors. So why do you want to say things the way your competitors are saying it? Figure out your own way of saying it. And again, your customers will tell you what that is. And then finally, the last aspect of that Venn diagram is a giant circle around all three circles, which is market realities. And so we can look at market realities today. I tend to use 2008 as a great example because, you know, we had that big collapse of the economy. Mercedes started selling their cars as value, high value, luxury car. Mercedes were luxury, were luxury. Suddenly, they became the company with the 5-year, 100,000-mile warranty, no payment. You know, get a new Mercedes, it's reliable, it's high value, you don't have to service it, right? As soon as that 2-year period of the crisis was over, guess who was a luxury car again?
Mercedes.
Mercedes was a luxury car again. Okay. And it wasn't like they let luxury go, but they were selling it as reliable and value. Whereas when that period of time, well, that was the market reality because, you know, the economy retracted, people didn't have as much money. They needed an excuse to give people an excuse to buy that car. And spending money on luxury during that time period wasn't happening a lot.
But is this also a case of positioning? Mercedes positioned itself in a time where everyone was not looking at luxury, they were looking at affordable. So they moved to that, and now when affordable has become luxury, they move back to luxury again.
Absolutely. And they never changed that underlying thread that Mercedes is a
Affordable car.
affordable, well, not affordable. They were selling value. Again, it wasn't affordability. They were still the same price tag, but they glopped onto it 100,000 miles, 5-year warranty on everything, right? Oh, great. I can buy that car and I'll never have to take it into the station. It'll never break down. It's all going to take care of, like, right? You know, that type of a thing. So that's the last thing, that market reality. You know, we've got that going on right now in the world with, you know, with everything that's happening. There is a global market reality that everybody's working through, whether it's inflation, gas prices, that type of thing. It affects your decision making, but it affects brands too, and how they communicate to the world because you can't divorce yourself from that. So you always have to have that kind of that perspective in the background. It doesn't drive your brand, but your brand has to understand what environment you're in when you're launching something.
You mentioned that you have been an educator and you mentor founders all around the world, San Francisco, Latin America, Chile, Puerto Rico. Is the dysfunction you treat same everywhere or does it change depending on where you are?
Yeah, it's the same, especially for startups. A lot of the startups I work with are either deep tech and science. And one of the reasons I kind of gravitated to that, because you have a lot of PhDs, scientists, people who come out of the lab or out of academia, and they're great at science. They're amazing at technology, but, you know, they're not great at storytelling. And, you know, I remember it, my first accelerator, this deep science accelerator, IndieBio out of San Francisco. You know, I went to an event and I'd ask a founder, tell me what you do. And a half hour later, they're still like, so after the Big Bang, you know, and it's like, you're going like, what? Like, I still don't know what you do or why it matters. And I actually went to one of the people who ran the accelerator, I go, like, you really need a help with the storytelling here. I'll come in and start doing it. And I loved it so much because it really was fun trying to help these people translate these brilliant ideas that were going to change the world in a way that they could raise funds, hire people, find business partners. I mean, that's really what you're trying to do, right? And so I started seeing myself more in the role of kind of like an economic catalyst. Like if I do these things for free, for pro bono, and I work with these people around the world, I could help them raise money. I could help them hire people. I could help them, you know, create an economic ripple. And just being a small part of their journey at that point really kind of gave me some more purpose for what I wanted to do and be. So that's how that ended up going. And it's just so much fun. And you meet the most amazing people. And I have friends from all over the world. You know, right now I'm working with one company, Durental. Their founder's out of Tunisia. I work with a company out of Lisbon called Musiversal, who is just an amazing music creation company. Gosh, I'm trying to think of where else. I'm working with a company right now out of Canada in the ag tech world. So a little bit of everywhere. It's quite fun.
I love your plate. You have this platter of every country in the world and every cuisine that you can get, and you have the everything that is on your plate is like beautifully created and curated, and you are just having the time of your life. I do want to ask at this point, how do you relax? Because you are doing so many things, and you mentioned it's more than 300 companies that you have worked with. What does relaxation look to you like? Please do not say marketing again, because
Well, yeah, if you asked Lauren, my wife, it's like I drive down the streets, I can't turn the brain off. I look at all the billboards and ads, I go like, that's horrible, that's terrible. What are they talking about? But that's just like turning it off, right? No, I go to a lot of music. Like I love music. I go to concerts, I go to sporting events. It's like every day's a gift. Even if you're working hard, it doesn't mean that you got it. It's called recreation, recreation, recreate. You got to recreate yourself. You've got to go out and do these things so your brain is fresh. But I'm, you know, like even when I'm traveling, like we're living in New York now for a month just for a chain of change of scenery, going to shows, visiting with friends, going to baseball games, that type of stuff. And I can't wait to get back to San Francisco because I'm exhausted right now. Like we're doing, but it doesn't mean that you can't work hard and play hard. You know, I know again, a lot of your listeners, it's like, oh, I don't want to go out tonight. I'm tired. I'm this, I'm that. It's like, shake it off, go. You'd be amazed at what happens when you show up or what you see or what you experience or what you do that you wouldn't have because you stayed home. That's what I do a lot of.
Talking about San Francisco, you are working with Portal 26, your consulting practice, mentoring, advising. After 40 years of helping other people find their focus, what's the thing that you have had to remind yourself of?
Oh my goodness. I think, you know, especially with my work with Portal 26, which is full time, it's just being humble every day and learning every day. And especially now, like, you know, with this, you know, the way that people work is changing right now. And you know, like with collective eye roll with everybody listening right now, AI, right? I think the importance is don't, again, you used a term before, don't lose the plot. AI is not marketing. AI is a tool. Just like when I first started working in 1983, they put a desktop on my desk. I replaced an IBM Selectric typewriter with a desktop computer. So what does that mean at the time? It changed how we worked. It changed how we worked. And we got huge efficiencies once we all learned how to use it. But the point I'm trying to make is that how you work and how you talk or reach people will always change. You know, like 150 years ago, nobody said, hey, what's your billboard strategy? Okay. You know, what's your radio strategy? You know, right? You know, it was like you had a marketing strategy. You have a marketing strategy, and all these things are tools. So, to answer your question, what's the thing to remember today? That all of this stuff is not a panacea for good storytelling and understanding your customer and building products that matter and work and solve a pain point and do what they're supposed to do. And I think people are forgetting that. And you see all this stuff that's out there. It's like AI this and AI that. I go, yeah, but that doesn't matter. Like, you know, what it really is a tool to eliminate toil. You know, that's what agents do. That's what, you know, generative, you know, the GPTs do, you know, and that's what they should be used for. They don't replace thinking. They don't replace writing. And all the people out there are like, yeah, but it's just a LinkedIn post. It's just an email. I go like, stop it. Stop it. Your brain is becoming mush. Like, just use it for what it's supposed to be used for. in my humble opinion, and I'm sure you'll get people to argue with me, I've cut 40% out of my day, but it doesn't write for me. And not a single email, not a single press release, not a single single LinkedIn post. Those are all thoughtful. I don't even do a draft. Why? Because it's wrong. It creates slop. And for me, I also have to keep my mind sharp. I can't get lazy. And so you're asking, what's the thing today? Is don't get lazy. Don't give in. Let the tools do the job and do the thinking for you, because it's so easy to do. And the GPT is like Claude, it just wants to make you happy.
I really agree with you on that one. And because we agree, I am gonna ask you the last question, or else we would have gone in a debate where AI is the useful thing. I agree, it's a tool and it should be only used to, help your life and not do your life. So I meet all these people who are in all praise of AI and it seems all great. But just on the page, in reality, in the real world, when you have to, start talking, they lose their words because the words have been written by ChatGPT and not by them. But on that note, what's the advice that you would be giving to any founder or a person or a new marketer or even a seasoned one right now that's gonna help them look forward in their life of marketing, where AI is a big proponent, but also creativity and original thought still stands the same value?
Yeah, that's, I mean, if I knew, maybe I wouldn't be talking to you right now. I'd be on my island in the Pacific that I owned if I had the answer to this, right? I just think it's like any technological breakthrough. There are intended and unintended consequences for everything that's out there. And just, I tell this to startups all the time. Nothing's as bad as you think it is, and nothing's as good as you think it is. It's always somewhere in the middle. And AI is like that. But in the world out there, I would tell all of you people, even I'm not being critical of AI, I'd say embrace it, play with it, use it, do things with it. Just don't be lazy with it, because the future job is going to be the people who understand how to manage and use and manipulate these tools for the good and to be productive. I don't see it as a job replacer. I see it as a job creator. Again, I get arguments with people, but I've been saying this from the beginning, that for a lot of people who might have had ideas that felt restricted or didn't have the experience or the tools to do something that they've always wanted to do, now the barrier is lower than ever. If you wanted to, do a direct to consumer or a service brand or open up a store or something like that, you don't have to have done it your whole life anymore. You can learn and use these tools and help you support your ambitions in interesting ways. From a marketing perspective, I think it's a force multiplier. And if you use it right to do the things that, for example, for my customers, I'll do a very simple spreadsheet where I'll pull from their competitors, their logo, their tagline, their about us, a few other tidbits from their website, just so I can understand how they're talking about themselves. It would take me 4 or 5 hours to do that. And when I did it, I'd read through the websites and try to understand them. Well, I can actually get, a GPT to do that for me, to build that spreadsheet. Yet I still go through and I check to make sure they're all right. I still go through the websites and read through the whole websites. However, it's taken that from a 5 or 6 hour job to a 2.5 hour to 3 hour job. Okay? It's not writing anything for me. It's not thinking for me. And by the way, I'm checking its work, but it has cut down the work for me and enabled me to spend more time, let's say, diving into their messaging or thinking about something else for that client or customer, And so I think that's how you have to look at these things, is how is it going to eliminate, as I said earlier, toil? But not replace strategic or creative thinking.
I like how you have framed this answer by saying how it's gonna replace the toil that you would be doing from reducing your time for 4 or 5 hours to a 2.5 hours, and also thoroughly rechecking and making sure that every fact is right, every answer is right, and
Sure.
rectifying the mistakes. Because most of the people overlook this part. The space where I'm critical of AI is when people are actually fully dependent on it. They act as if it's the functioning brain of themselves and not the actual brain that they have. People forget that AI was created, and the input of AI is a lot of human work. So it's the humans who are the architects of everything that it is creating or recreating. And when ChatGPT started, or the AI when it started, it was just regurgitating what is already present in the world. It did not have an original thought. And even now, when I think, okay, let's say for this podcast, I did have the help of AI to, restructure the questions that I was going to ask, but it had my original thought behind it. It had the questions that I had in mind. And then it restructured it. It did not recreate it. It restructured it in a way that is, comprehensible to the person that I'm talking to. It is also appealing to the listeners. And also, it is making sense for us to be having a conversation. Versus the questions that I would ask it to generate on its own were the really trashy kind, without any original thought behind it, without any personality behind it. It would just, input a profile and gloss over the main facets of the life that the person has lived and pick on the few keywords that it thinks is really important for the person to be asked about. But that's not what this is about. It is about getting to know the story behind the person, to know how the person has lived their whole structure. And same goes for the brand. You can input a feed of, a chain of commands, but it's not gonna know your actual brand. It's not gonna understand the emotion behind it because it is actually artificial intelligence. It's not alternative intelligence, as some people, rephrase it. It's
It's not
not that, it's
actual intelligence,
artificial.
right? Yeah. I'm in violent agreement with you. I think everybody senses at this time, because this will be kind of like a bit of a time capsule, right? We're May 12th of 2026. Talking about this, it's really just the beginning of the timeline of this. Everybody's, like, and the pace of change is so rapid, it's hard for us to keep up with. It's going to be 4 or 5 years before we really realize the consequences of all of this and where it's going. And we're all kind of adapting. But next year, the conversations are going to be a lot different than they are today. I think one of the things that's going on right now is, backlash is probably too hard of a word, but this push back towards human versus machine, and what it means and where things are going. Like I talked about Museversal, the company that I work with out of Lisbon. What are they doing? They have a roster of world-class musicians, some of them Grammy Award winners. They've played with some of the top artists of the world. So if you need a cello, a pianist, a singer, a producer, a songwriter, all of this roster of like 130 different incredibly talented people. And for just 200 something dollars a month for members, you can interact with all of these people to create your music in a recording session. Where you give live feedback and you hear them play your music and you talk to them, can you do this? Can you do this? And it's magical to see this amazing collaboration take place because you'll never replace that. And so I'm not saying Splice is bad, great tool and all these other digital things aren't great to make samples and sounds. That's part of making music today. But people love it because there's the human magic that occurs when people get together and collaborate and jam and feed off of each other and listen. And I think people are starting to crave that more. I see this when I walk around now, and I've started, saying to Lauren, I go, I like where we are right now. It's heads up. Heads up means that everybody is having such a good time that the phones are in their pockets. Nobody's texting, nobody's taking pictures, just everybody's in the moment. And I'm starting to see so much more of that now than I did even a year ago, where people are just trying to be more present. And it's a nice thing to see. And I wish more people were heads up instead of heads down.
I agree with you. For this exact reason, I have stopped carrying my phone outside. My phone stays at home all the time, and it's not out with me when I'm out with my leisure walks or, getting grocery, because I would find too often that I was, buried too deep into my phone, looking at the next trend, looking at the next thing that's popping off, and it would actually pop my head off, and it
Yeah.
was so hard to control it. But yeah, I am glad you picked on that thing. Heads up is. And the movie also was that Heads Up. Have you seen that movie?
Oh no, oh the apocalypse movie. No,
Yes,
this is a
yes.
different heads up. I'm talking about a good heads up where
Yeah, no,
you're
it just
actually
reminded me
enjoying
of
the
that
company.
one. Yeah.
Yeah.
That is true. This has been a lovely, lovely conversation with you, Neil, today. I had in between some trouble keeping up with how paced you were with things. But that just shows the career span, the trajectory you have. It's not even a career at this point. It's been your life. We
Yeah.
were in conversation about your life in the last N number of years that you have worked with 300 plus companies. You have architected every single strategy on how that brand might be working today. And that says a lot, because most of us do not even get to work with plus 10 brands or companies,
Sure.
let's say. And you have over 300 under your belt is like amazing. So it's not just a career anymore. It's your life, and how beautifully curated you have at that. It's amazing to see, and we hope to see more of your work in upcoming times. And that is a given, of course, because you're currently working and advising a lot more companies.
Right. Well, hopefully you'll see more of Portal 26. It's on the, so that's interesting because it's on the user side of AI. It's how you manage users and agents in the enterprise, not the building the LLMs and the agents and that side of it. It's making sure that companies achieve the goals they want to achieve with AI by properly understanding use cases and what agents to build and securing it on the inside so people aren't putting dumb things on it like company intellectual property. We created the category, which was really exciting. That's one of the reasons why I jumped on board. It's like, how often in your life do you get to create a category? And we've had 20 competitors follow. None of them are as good as we are, thank goodness, at least in my brain, but our customers seem to like us.
You'll
So
get to that point also when you
I can't.
rectify the image.
Yeah, I know. Well, but that's it. Like we had an hour and a half conversation last week, or like, how do we hone in on these different profiles and what do they really care? And we brought in outside experts from the category to help coach us on this kind of stuff because you never know unless you talk to the customer, right? So still putting it in practice, even though I'm in-house for this. But so hopefully you'll hear more about that. A couple of the other projects I'm working on are pretty exciting. I'll look forward to those companies doing well. One of those companies was probably going public in the fall, so we'll see how that goes.
Fingers crossed it goes amazingly well for you and the company. So,
Well, that company, no. I'll just get my consulting fee for that, unfortunately. It'll be a big one.
fingers crossed for that one. And yeah, I wish this conversation could go on longer and longer. It would go throughout the day, but it has been a great conversation with you. And I'm actually very jealous of the people you have worked with throughout your lifetime, because what a powerhouse you are. Immensely amazing powerhouse of a person.
Oh, you're just way too generous. I've been very fortunate to work with some amazing people. As a matter of fact, I was out to dinner last night with somebody I hired back in 1986.
Wow. It might have brought so many memories back to the surface, and also to have lived throughout that span of things where everything has changed. And everything is being rebuilt right now, as some people would say. But yeah, that's amazing. I am at a loss of words, but the only thing that comes to my mind is just it's beautiful and it's wonderful to be in your company.
As I told you earlier, flattery will get you everywhere. You're very, very too kind and too generous. And I hope your listeners got something out of the conversation today. Just remember, just be kind to everybody, treat people like you want to be treated, and things will work out.
Thank you so much, Neil. Thank you so much.